William Gibson made his name with the novel Neuromancer, a seminal work published in 1984. Very good year for sci-fi, that. 19 years later, pattern recognition hit the shelves, and now we take it off, dust it down, and read it for your pleasure. Enjoy.
When Case first moved to New York, her father had insisted she take lessons in self-defense from a small, fastidious, slightly portly Scotsman called Bunny. Case had argued that New York was no longer as dangerous as Wynne remembered, which was true, but it had been easier to visit Bunny 6 times than to argue with Wynne. Bunny, her father had told her, had been an SAS man. But when she'd asked Bunny about this, he'd said that he had always been too fat for the SAS and had, in fact, been a medic. Bunny favored cardigans and Tattersall shirts, was very nearly her father's age, and told her he would teach her how hard men fought in pubs. So while some of her friends dabbled in Thai boxing, she'd been schooled in no more than half a dozen moves most often used in the maximum security wing of British prisons. Bunny's preferred term for this was making mayhem. Now, with a Prada clone trying to free her bag, it comes to her what she's supposed to do in the Bunny plan of things. Make mayhem. She shoves her arm suddenly forward, just far enough to grab the glove-thin leather of both his lapels. And as the second assailant inadvertently cooperates, yanking her arms back, she pulls with all her might and smashes her forehead as far as she can into Prada's nose. She's unprepared for both the pain it causes her and the extraordinarily intimate sound of cartilage crushing against her forehead. His dead weight, as he abruptly collapses, pulls his lapels from her hands, reminding her to step back, off-balancing whoever is behind her, look down between her legs, a man's shoe black with that horrible squared-off toe, and stamp as hard as she can with her heel on the revealed instep, producing a remarkably shrill scream from close behind her left ear. Pull loose and run. And run was invariably the footnote to any of Bunny's lessons. She tries to, the laptop banging painfully against her hip as she bolts for the end of the alley, which is instantly blocked by a silver scooter and its silver helmeted rider, who flips up the mirrored visor. It's Boon Chu. His mouth is open, but she can't hear him. She straddles the scooter, all in the logic of a dream, and sees him do something with his hand that throws them forward, leaving her with the confused image of the two black-clad men, one trying to hop as he pulls the other, the one she's headbutted, to his feet. In front of her, the RAF roundel on the back of Boon Chu's parka as she grabs him around the waist, going very fast between two lines of cars waiting at an intersection, their polished doors gleaming like jellyfish in a neon sea. He stops where the alley intersects a wider one. A pair of tough-eyed Japanese kids throw down cigarettes as he hands one of them his helmet and unzips his parka. "What are you doing here?" asks Case as she dismounts and tugs her skirt down. "Give him your jacket," he says, pointing at the second kid. She pulls the Rixons off and hands it to the boy, noticing a missing finger joint on his hand as he hops onto the scooter behind his partner, pulls on the jacket. Then they are gone. "What are you doing here?" she asks.
"Watching them watch you. You've got blood on your forehead," he tells her.
"It's okay," she says. "It's not mine. Where did they go with the bike?"
"Back to see where your two friends are."
"They look like us."
"That's the idea."
"What if those men catch them?"
"The idea is they might wish they hadn't."
Their cab negotiates another narrow lane. Boon Chu says something in Japanese, but not to the driver. Speaking into his cellular headset, he looks back through the cab's rear window. More Japanese. "Have they found them?" she asks.
"No."
"Did Taki get away?"
"Yeah, he was the guy with the number."
She resists the urge to check for the napkin. "What if the ink is running?" "When did you get here?"
"I was right behind you in coach."
Suspicion prickling the back of her scalp, she asks, "Why?"
"We were followed when we left the restaurant in Camden Town. Young guy, brown hair, black jacket. Followed us for a while, stuck with me when we split up. Lost him in Covent Garden. I told you, I was in security."
"Then you followed me?" He says something in Japanese into his headset.
We're working for Big End. Are the people following us working for Big End? If not...
Well?
No idea so far. I followed those two last night, and they were speaking Italian.
What were they saying?
I don't speak Italian.
She huffs at that.
Where are we going now? The bike is following us to make sure nobody else is. When we're sure of that, we'll go to a friend's apartment.
They didn't find those men?
No. The one you buttered is probably in a clinic now getting his nose taped back into shape.
He creases his forehead.
You didn't learn that studying marketing, did you?
No.
They might be Blue Ant for all we know. You might have just broken the nose of a junior creative director.
Somehow this doesn't bother her. The next junior creative director who tries to mug you, you might break his nose too. The cab is on some kind of metropolitan freeway now, curving past woods and ancient walls, the Imperial Palace. She turns and looks back, trying to see the scooter, but discovers her neck is painfully stiff.
Boone points at her bag. They were trying to get the laptop?
My purse is in there, too, and my phone. As if on cue, the Blue Ant phone starts to ring.
She digs it out. Remember me? Says a mildly familiar voice. It's your parka boy. How'd it go?
Things got complicated, says Case. She hears him sigh in Chicago.
It's okay, he replies. I live for fatigue poisons.
We did meet, she tells him, wondering if Boon Chu can hear his side of the conversation.
No doubt about that, says Parka Boy excitedly. He hasn't even waited to get home. He's gone straight into an internet cafe, and he's pouring his heart out to Keiko as we speak.
I want to talk, says Case, but it has to be later. I'm sorry.
He told Keiko he gave you the number, so I wasn't too worried.
Email me. Click.
Friend, says Boon Chu.
Footage head, Chicago. He found Taki.
And you did get the number?
No getting around it now. Either she lies to him because she doesn't trust him, or tells him because, relatively speaking, she does. She digs around, then shows him the napkin.
And you didn't enter it in the laptop? Email it to anyone?
No.
That's good, because I need to check that it hasn't been compromised.
They head up a poorly lit flight of bare wooden stairs and along a corridor so narrow she has to walk behind him. A single fluorescent tube flickers somewhere overhead. He stops, and she hears the rattle of keys. A door opens, and he steps inside, flicking a light switch. Case steps in and finds herself trying to remember her father's clever neurological explanation of déjà vu. Strange, but somehow familiar, the lighting consists of glass bulbs with dim orange filaments. Reproduction Edison bulbs, their light insufficient and magical. Furniture low and somehow like the building itself, worn, strangely comforting, still in use. Who lives here? She asks, looking at his laptop and phone sitting on a low central table, his suitcase open beside it.
Marissa, a friend of mine, fabric designer. She's in Madrid right now. I'll make tea.
She walks to one of two sliding paper windows inset with central panes of frosted glass. Through the clear section, she looks out at gently sloping rooftops, corrugated iron, rusted a rich and uneven brown. A large tan insect strobes through the communal patch of light, vanishes. This is an amazing place, she says.
There aren't many left, he calls from the kitchen, rattling canisters in a search for tea.
She hears the kettle come to a boil. Do you know Dorothea Benedetti? She asks.
No.
She works for Heinze and Pfaff, the graphics people. She deals with Blue Ant for them. Back in London, I think she had someone break into my apartment for her. They used the computer.
How do you know?
She walks over to what she guesses is a storage alcove. A woman's clothes are hung there along a pole, and they make her feel somehow self-conscious. But she tells him the story then. Dorothea, the hole in the Rixons, the dodgy website on her browser. By the time she finishes, they're sitting cross-legged on cushions on the tatami floor, the light off, drinking green tea he pours from an earthenware pot.
So it might be that our Italians here aren't about the fact that you're working for Big End or about the footage, Boone says. The break-in predated all that.
She studies his face in the glow of the bamboo filaments.
Dorothea knows something about me, she says. Something very personal. A phobia. Something that only my parents, my therapist, a few close friends would know. That worries me.
Could you tell me what it is?
I'm allergic to certain trademarks. It's the downside of my ability to judge the market's response to new logo designs. She feels herself blushing and hates that.
Can you give me an example?
The Michelin Man, for one. There are others. Some are more contemporary. It's not something I'm very comfortable talking about, actually.
He frowns, pours more tea.
I think Dorothea wanted you to go away, back to New York, he says thoughtfully. But you didn't, and then I turned up, and my guess is that she's behind the men who've been following you.
Why?
No way to tell yet, but if you give me your laptop, then maybe I can start getting us some answers.
When she gets back to the hotel, feeling somehow reassured in some non-specific way by Boone's cheery confidence in his abilities as a security tech geek, she finds a brand new Rickson's in a blue ant bag. Unworn, carefully wrapped in black tissue paper. This morning seems a very long time ago. In the bathroom mirror, clinically illuminated, her forehead looks only slightly bruised. She unwraps a bar of soap, reminds herself not to use a hotel shampoo, which will have the wrong pH for Guy Jean hair, and shuts herself in the glass-walled shower, a shower approximately the size of Boone's girlfriend's kitchen. Girlfriend. She feels a stab of jealousy and decides to eat. The pizza turns out to be very good, though very Japanese, but the potatoes are amazing. A Rickson's-like super simulacrum of a Western classic. She needs to check her email. She needs to phone Blue Ant about getting out of here as soon as possible, and really, she should phone Parka Boy. One email from Parka Boy with a JPEG attachment.
No rest for the wicked. After emailing Keiko from two separate cafes, no less, Taki got home and sent the attached.
She clicks on the JPEG. A map. A broken T scribed with city streets and strings of numbers, like a steak's T-bone. Within its outline are avenues, squares, circles, a long rectangle suggesting a park. She wrinkles up her forehead and clicks back on her inbox.
In a new frenzy of adoration, Taki has sent this. I think that these mystic twonks have battened onto the footage not in a footage head way, but simply for the sake of solving a puzzle. To save you the bother of counting them, there are 135 numbers on the map, each consisting of three groups of four digits. If each segment is watermarked with one of these numbers, we have, for the first time, a geography of sorts, maybe even a way of working out the order. I'm looking into a graphic spot that only searches the net for maps. Meanwhile, exhausted, baffled, but unhealthily excited, I remain Parka Boy.
She gets up, comes back with a napkin, checks the number written on it against the cloud of numbers partially masking the T city on her screen. She finds it. Her scalp prickles. She phones Blue Ant to get her the hell out of Tokyo. It is 6 in the morning. Blue Ant have her on a flight out just after noon. She goes to the window, powers open the blinds, and dimly discovers Tokyo at the bottom of an aquarium of rainy light. Gust-driven moisture shotguns the glass. Her cell rings.
Boone here. Meet you in the lobby at 8:30. I called Blue Ant, got reservations for both of us.
Something about a lack of autonomy here that bothers her.
See you, he says.
She's able to get in a workout, shower and wash her hair, then pack and make the lobby by 8:30. Boone arrives minutes later in his black horsehide coat, carrying his own small leather suitcase. She picks up her own generic nylon bag, and they walk out past the bamboo grove and into the elevator.
Waking to the offer of a hot washcloth, for an instant, she believes she's still on her way to Tokyo, that it's all been a dream.
This terrifies her, and she hurts her neck, craning round to see if Boone is still there behind her. He is, in fact, still there, in the nearest seat, looking strangely cancelled in a black blindfold. They hadn't much to say to each other on the train to the airport. She'd slept in the lounge after security measures that included a sort of CAT scan for their shoes and answering questions in front of an infrared device that registered minute changes in the temperature of the skin around the eyes, the theory being that lying about packing one's own bag induced an invisible and inevitable microblush. Boone had been impressed and told her to expect the blush machine soon in America. She told him as they were boarding that she'd gotten something more from Taki, but that she was too tired to explain it, that she'd show it to him when she'd had more sleep. What is that all about, she wonders, holding back like that? Something to do with something she'd felt in that apartment. She doesn't want to examine this too closely, but there's also a way in which she simply finds him too pushy. She frowns, seeing for the first time how working for Big End with Boone Chu has skewed her relationship to the footage head community. Even Parker Boy, who's been instrumental in all this, doesn't know what she's up to, who she's working for. This makes her think of London and what to do when she gets there. She still has the keys to the flat in her bag. That's where she feels like going, really, though the residual ache in her forehead is causing her doubt. Would someone have been able to fiddle the locks in the meantime? A burglar might have got in again. But her only other option is a London hotel. And even with Blue Ant footing the bill, she's feeling hoteled out. That decides it. The Heathrow Express to Paddington, a cab to Camden, then more sleep. Decision made, she flips back to bed mode and puts on her blindfold. When they exit immigration, Big End is waiting, the only smiling face in a scrum of glum chauffeurs holding hand-lettered sheets of cardboard. He really does seem to have far too many teeth. His Stetson is set too squarely on his head, and he's wearing a long, very expensive-looking raincoat.
"Right this way, please," Big End says, making a big show of taking the luggage trolley from Boone, and they follow him out to the Hummer,
parked where she's certain no one at all is allowed to park, ever. "You did need to pick us up, Hubertus," she says when they are underway.
"Not at all," he replies ambiguously. "I want to hear all about it."
Which he does, mainly via Boone, but, Case gradually notes, with two serious omissions. Boone never mentions the headbutting or Taki's JPEG. He tells Big N they went to Tokyo to follow up a lead suggesting that at least one segment of the footage has an encrypted watermark. Case looks straight ahead, forcing herself to concentrate on the arcing of the wipers. Boone is lying to Big End, or at least holding back information, and now she feels that she is, too. She briefly considers bringing up Dorothea, just to send things in a direction Boone isn't expecting, but she has no idea of his agenda for lying, and she's still too tired for a jack move. But the next time they're alone together, she needs to have this out with him. To her considerable embarrassment and confusion, they have to wake her when the Hummer pulls up outside her rented apartment. Boone carries her bag to the door and obviously wants to be invited in. "I'm tired," she tells him. "Don't worry, I'll be fine." She unlocks the door, feeling like an idiot, manages a smile for both of them, and goes in. Sleep takes her down fast and very deep, whirls her through places too fragmentary to call dreams, then spits her abruptly back to the surface. By the light in her watch, she sees that she's been asleep no more than 45 minutes. She gets up, pulls on jeans and sweater, and hobbles barefoot down the stairs, moving as she imagined she might move if she lived to be 80. This is beyond soul delay metaphors now. It's into physical collapse. In the bathroom, she avoids looking at herself altogether, fearing what might be revealed. Showers quickly, towels, puts her clothes back on, before creeping back upstairs, desperately pretending she's someone very tired, which she supposes she is, who is about to fall deeply and soundly asleep, which she very much doubts she will. But she does, to her subsequent amazement, a shallow but mercifully uninhabited sleep, though with a certain sense of sound and fury.
Pilates studio, she tries to become just another lost tourist, though she knows she'll never be one. Case knows that she is and has long been complicit, though in what is harder to say. Complicit in whatever it is that makes London and New York more like each other, that dissolves the membranes between mirror worlds. She knows too much about the process responsible for the way product is positioned in the world. And sometimes she finds herself doubting that there is much else going on. But this is a mood, she tells herself. A bad one, in its low-key way, dealt by soul delay. Somewhere, that lagging part of her is being wound in. And her job here is simply to walk, to be in London, and let her body know she is here. The rain has stopped, but drops still fall from ledges and awnings, beating on the nylon of her new Rixons. Absently, she reaches to touch the place where the tape should be, but it isn't there. No hole. History erased via the substitution of an identical object. Suddenly, she remembers the hard grip of the man in Tokyo, the one who'd come from behind. She hasn't really felt the fear in that before now, and now it comes up from her core, a cold thing and hard. Food. She moves along until she finds a sandwich shop, small and pre-globalized, but also rather smart. She gets egg salad on a narrow baguette, a cup of filter coffee, and carries them to a small table by the window. She'd first seen Covent Garden after a heavy snow, walking hand in hand with her father, and she remembers the secret silence of London then, the amazing hush of it, slush crunching beneath her feet. The Blue Ant's cell rings. Annoyed, her thoughts interrupted, she fumbles it out. Big End. He tells her they have to talk, and quickly. Basic business instinct suppresses the groan, but only barely. He wants to send a car. She says she'll walk. He clicks off. Then the phone rings again immediately. Parka Boy.
I'm having a problem, he says, with Judy.
Judy?
Judy Suzuki. Keiko.
The girl in the picture? He explains patiently.
She likes to drink after work. The problem is, Judy feels sorry for Taki. She wants to write back to him, send him more pictures, real ones this time.
Case sighs wearily. You're a dickhead. I'm a dickhead myself for going along with this. Two older British women look at her as they enter, look away. So, what do you want from me? Parka Boy tells her he wants to know how to make Judy go away. You don't. You can't. Let her write to Taki, she says.
I was afraid you were going to say that. You sound tired.
I am, but I'm okay. He rings off. She looks at the phone and wonders who Parka Boy is, other, that is, than Parka Boy, acerbic obsessive theorist of the footage. She has no idea. No idea what he looks like or what he does when he's not doing this, how he came to be so devoted to the footage. But in some way she can't quite grasp. The universe of the footage is everting, manifesting physically in the world. And she's glad that someone else, this Judy, doesn't like what they've done to Taki. As she's reaching out to push the button on the Blue Ant intercom, the door is opened by a dark-haired man in sunglasses, his nose elaborately braced with flesh-colored fabric tape. He freezes for an instant, does an odd little duck and weave, then pushes suddenly past her outstretched arm and sprints off down the street. She steps inside, the back of her neck prickling. She asks the receptionist who it was that left, the one with tape on his nose.
Oh, Franco, the girl says brightly. He draws for Dorothea, been in an accident.
She's here?
Waiting for you, the girl smiles. Third floor.
Good morning,
Big End exclaims. He is seated at the head of a long table. Dorothea is seated to his left, down the table's side, toward the door, closer to Case. Boone sits opposite her. Neither Boone nor Dorothea say anything. Case closes the door behind her, hard. Big End begins to placate her.
Shut up!
It isn't a voice Case has often heard, but she knows when she hears it that it's her own. Hubertus starts to open his mouth. Case points at Dorothea.
Did you just hire her?
It is Dorothea who speaks.
It would be too much to expect you not to be angry, she says with the utmost calm.
She's wearing something soft-looking, in a very dark gray, but her hair is straining as tightly as ever.
"The man," Case says, "who tried to mug me in Tokyo..."
"I'm sorry about that," Dorothea says. "If I had been there, it wouldn't have happened. Franco is not so heavy-handed, but someone was demanding results."
She doesn't shrug exactly, but somehow conveys the sense of having done so. Case swings back to Big End.
"Knowing all this, you hire her?"
"Yes," Big End nods patiently, "because we need her on our side."
"Case," Dorothea says,
"it's a career decision for me."
She puts a particular stress on career that might once have been heard more often on religious.
"Blue Ant is where I need to be. Hubertus knows this."
"But Hubertus," Case offers, "what if Dorothea is a vicious, lying..." Big End giggles, a deeply alarming sound.
"Well," he says, "we are in the business of advertising, after all. But you're talking about loyalty, not honesty. And I have a strong yet simple faith that Dorothea can be counted on to be totally loyal to... her career."
He looks at Dorothea, his expression suddenly quite cold. Reluctantly, Case realizes he might be right about the Italian witch. He's buying her allegiance with the one thing literally no one else can offer her, a fast-track position in Blue Ant. And as Case recognizes this, she's suddenly very curious as to what it is that Dorothea knows. Boone, Case notes to her considerable resentment, looks attentive but absolutely neutral, some kind of major Chinese guy poker face going on. "So tell me," she says, facing Dorothea, pointedly ignoring Boone, "what Hubertus imagines I'll find so very interesting."
Pattern Recognition was written by award-winning novelist William Gibson. It was abridged by Ron Roberts, produced by David Jackson Young, and read for BBC Radio 7 by Lorelei King.